Hezekiah's reign over Judah is covered in three chapters of 2 Kings. That's chapters 18 through 20. And then we also have 2 Chronicles chapters 29 through 32. So that's seven chapters between the two books that cover the reign of Hezekiah. And that's obviously not with some of that space devoted to covering the goings-on in the northern kingdom, because it's no longer in existence. So all we have left now is the kingdom of Judah. So the fact that we have seven chapters in between 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and not only that, of course, we have some in verbatim, we have several of those chapters that are in the book of Isaiah, particularly in chapters 36 through 39 of Isaiah. So that's actually four more chapters. So those ones in Isaiah are exactly covering essentially word for word what we have here in the books of the Kings. But that means we have 11 entire chapters of the Old Testament to this time period under the reign of Hezekiah. So if we knew nothing else about what's in those 11 chapters, the fact that the Lord gives us 11 chapters of material about his reign, does that alone tell us that this is a very important time period and an important example that we have from what was going on in Hezekiah's time? I mean, that we should be able to at least discern that much without even going into the details of it. I mean, the Lord has given us a lot of information, a lot of teachings in detail about what was going on with Hezekiah under his reign. And we have events mentioned here that are covered by several of the other prophets. So it's not like these circumstances or situations, these events aren't mentioned elsewhere in God's word. They are. We also should mention, when we think of the book of Proverbs, whose name is immediately comes to mind? When you think of the book of Proverbs, who do you think of? Solomon, which is that's the right one to think about. I mean, he's the one that the Lord gave all those proverbs to, and of course the book of Proverbs begins with the statement, "The Proverbs of Solomon." So that's how the book begins. The book of Proverbs contains all of these words the Lord gave through him. But it's interesting in the way the book of Proverbs is organized. From that beginning all the way from chapters 1 through 24, we have the material that is therein, that when we get to Proverbs 25 and verse 1, he says, "These are also Proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied out." So there's some transition point between chapters 1 to 24 and then 25 to 31 in the book of Proverbs. I mean, at least it suggests that there was whatever, there's some order to what comes in the first 24 chapters of Proverbs, and then there's something different as far as the ordering of it from 24 to 31. We're not given the details of what that is, other than the fact that the Lord does specify and tells us that there is that. There's a difference, some difference there between chapters 24 and 25, and before and after. But since we can't really tell the details of what is different about that, I mean, the Lord considered it significant to tell us, but also he considered it significant to tell us who it was and whose men did this work, and who was concerned with this wisdom in the Proverbs to have his men to copy out these things. I mean, this is telling us again something about Hezekiah. So we find Hezekiah all over the Old Testament, mentioned in not just the books of the Kings, but four chapters in Isaiah, the book of Proverbs, and many of the other prophets. We have many of them whose the time that the Lord had used them was within the time period of Hezekiah being king of Judah, and he's mentioned in several other books of the prophets. So he is certainly one of the most mentioned of the kings in the Old Testament, if not men of the Old Testament. Very important example we have with Hezekiah, king of Judah. There's no doubt or questioning of that. We've already looked in 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 through 4, giving us background information about him and who he was. And we also saw along with that the first two verses of 2 Chronicles chapter 29 that parallel that. Almost word for word. Well, there's an almost word for word repeat of 2 Kings 18, 1 to 3, and 2 Chronicles 29, 1 and 2. The main difference, or at least the piece of information that's given in 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 1 that we don't find in 2 Chronicles 29, is the tie-in to when Hezekiah's reign began in relation to Hoshea, who was the last king of the northern kingdom of Israel. It makes sense that that would be in 2 Kings 18, which up to this point, with the destruction of the northern kingdom under Hoshea, which was covered in the previous chapter, the focus was on, up to that point in 2 Kings, was primarily on the events, the goings-on in that northern kingdom of Israel and the kings that were ruling there. And so as the kings of Judah were brought in, it would tie into their reigns as it connected to the kings of the northern kingdom. And so Hezekiah is tied in with that last one, and that's why we do find that mentioned in the very opening words of 2 Kings 18. But he began his reign in Hoshea's third year. He was 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. And then the key point in 2 Kings 18 and verse 3, that he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father did, which that statement is repeated in 2 Chronicles 29 and verse 2. So God tells us that about Hezekiah. As far as information about Hezekiah, that statement is really the important summary of his life. Now we're going to have another very important statement in verse 5 here in 2 Kings 18 that we want to get to, Lord willing, in just a moment. But that statement describing Hezekiah's life, and this is a God-given statement, that this man lived his life on this earth doing what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father did. If I could leave this world and if God could would state about my life that I did what was right in his sight like David did, I would be very happy to take that to eternity. And I think we all would, wouldn't we? Could you have really a better statement or summary of your life than if God said that? So that tells us the goodness that was in this man. It also shows us a difference between Hezekiah and the other kings of Judah, with only two exceptions that we've read about up to this point. We mentioned that God makes the same statement there that he does about Hezekiah and his life doing what was right in his sight like David. He only says that about Asa and Jehoshaphat. Now later Josiah would be the only other one. So there's four in total that God describes in that way. That's it. But Hezekiah was the third of these. That shows it was a very rare thing. Now, the kings that we've been looking at, well, the one that was right before Hezekiah, his father Ahaz. The Lord told us he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He was like the kings of Israel, those wicked kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. That's who he's described as being like, not like David. Now, before him, before Ahaz, the four kings that preceded Ahaz, so when we're looking at Hezekiah's, the generations that came before him that he descended from, it's all the more remarkable that we find that statement about Hezekiah's life, that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord like David, considering his father was one that was evil, the most evil king that Judah had up to this point, and was like the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. That's his own father. And the four generations before that were ones that we were told, starting with Joash, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest, the one who had raised him. When Jehoiada died, what did Joash do? Off he went. He turned away from the Lord. And then his son, Amaziah, said that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord like his father, Joash, had done. And what do we know then? What did Amaziah do after beginning his life serving the Lord? What did he do after that? He departed from him, like Joash did. And then his son Ahaziah, also known as Uzziah, we were told that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like his father Amaziah had done. Well, what did Uzziah do after he had served the Lord at the beginning of his reign, and the Lord made him to prosper in all that he did and strengthened him? And then when he was made strong, what did he do? He was lifted up in pride and he departed from the Lord. He's the one that went into the temple. And the priest, he wouldn't listen to the priest telling him that he couldn't go into the temple. That was unlawful. He became so proud that he did not believe any of God's laws applied to him anymore. And God struck him with leprosy in there. And then he was dwelt in a several house thereafter. And then his son Jotham reigned, and we were told that Jotham did what was right in the sight of the Lord like his father Uzziah had done. So we had four in a row before Ahaz that served the Lord when they were younger and then departed from him. None of those served the Lord like David. And then you had Ahaz, who didn't do what was right in the sight of the Lord at any point in his life from what the Lord said. So that's the background that comes into Hezekiah's time. So if anybody were going to offer an excuse for saying, well, based on my rotten family, I didn't know any better. As far as doing what was right. It's not my fault. Look at this terrible family I came from. I mean, Hezekiah, if anybody could have had such an excuse, which nobody does, even though people have been blaming others for their decisions to do wrong from the very beginning. Who was the first one that did that? His name was Adam. The woman you gave me, she gave me. I mean, he simultaneously blamed the Lord and Eve for his eating the fruit. I mean, Eve's the one that gave it to him, but who's the one that gave Eve to Adam? So making excuses and blaming other people when someone hasn't done right, that goes back to the very beginning. Nothing new there. But Hezekiah didn't do that. He didn't say, well, I've got a rotten father, so therefore I'm free to be evil and I can blame it on him. Or the four that of my ancestors, generations that came before him. No, Hezekiah did what was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that that David, his father, had done. And that was because Hezekiah, like everybody else, according to what the Lord tells us, and we all know Romans 1 and 18 through 21 that we've read so many times, that the Lord has revealed his eternal power and godness to whom? To everyone. How? By the creation, by the things that are made. It's clearly seen, he says, so that they're without excuse. did Hezekiah, no matter how wicked his father Ahaz was, did Hezekiah know that he had an eternally powerful creator that put him on this earth, that he belonged to and was responsible for glorifying his God? He knew that just like the rest of us do. The difference was he held that truth in righteousness, and he did glorify God as God. But he had no excuse for not seeking his creator. He had a creator just like everybody else does, and knows it, knew it, just like we all do, because God has revealed that to us all. So we're all responsible for making that decision, and we have no one to blame if we don't. We have no excuse, as the Lord says plainly there in Romans 1:21. We're without excuse for no matter how wicked anybody is around us. We have no excuse for not seeking the God who made us and put us here. It is he that hath made us and not we ourselves. I mean, who doesn't know that? Which one of us doesn't know that we didn't create ourselves and put ourselves here into this pasture that we also didn't make? All of this was made by God and it all belongs to him. We all know that, and we need to be like Hezekiah, and no matter what anybody else does or doesn't do, we need to have our determination there that we're going to glorify God as God and then do it. And he did. We found the first specific mention of the good that he did after he became king in verse 4, where it says he removed the high places and break the images. This is 2 Kings 18, verse 4. He removed the high places and break the images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan, which means something made from copper or brass or whatever. So this was just a thing to Hezekiah, an evil thing it had become. And that's where we finished off last week. Moses had made that brazen serpent back in Numbers chapter 21. That's in verses 4 through 9. At yet another point in Israel's horrible history in the wilderness, where they were murmuring against the Lord. Now keep in mind, Numbers 21, certain chapter numbers are very, very pivotal and should be ingrained in our minds. One of those in the book of Numbers is chapter 14. Numbers 14 is that's the chapter that records when the Lord said, after he'd been tempted those 10 times, they'd already murmured and complained against him all those times. The spies had gone into the land of Canaan and spent 40 days and 40 nights there. Keep that little tidbit in mind for the next hour. We're going to try to get back to that situation. So if you're paying attention now, that'll help. That'll pay dividends the next hour too, Lord willing. But anyway, those spies went into Canaan, and they spent 40 days and 40 nights there, Joshua and Caleb among them. And they came back, and those two gave the good report of the land, and it was a land that flowed with milk and honey. And the fact that it was filled with strong cities with high walls, and there were giants there, and that meant nothing to the Lord. How was it going to be any problem for the Lord how many people there were there and how big they were, the walls of their cities? What was that? What would that be to God? Absolutely nothing. And Caleb and Joshua understood that, and they were ready to go, and they were encouraged, let's go up. The Lord's promised us this land. It's a good land. Let's go up there and get it. Let him deliver it to us like he's promised. Their trust was fully in him. The other 10 spies whined and murmured, and, oh, there are too many people. They're too big, and they're too strong in their cities. And so then that's in Numbers 14. The people decided they were going to appoint themselves a captain to lead them back to their bondage in Egypt. And were ready to stone Joshua and Caleb and Moses for opposing them. And that's when God made the decision. He was done with that generation. And he told them that they would not enter into the land of Canaan. They were going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. So Numbers 14 was pivotal in the, from that standpoint, that that's the chapter where the Lord said, no more. He was not going to, there was nothing from that point onward that was going to change his mind to allow that generation to enter Canaan. Now we know also the Holy Spirit swore, now you read Psalm 95, this is quoted in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4, but the Holy Spirit swore in his wrath that that generation wouldn't enter into God's rest in reference to eternity. Now, which would be the real problem for them? Now, did Moses get to go into Canaan? No. And in Numbers 20, when he struck the rock, when the Lord told him to speak to it, must we fetch you water out of this rock, you rebels? And he, in his anger, he struck the rock, and then the Lord told him he was not going to be able to enter Canaan. The Lord took him up to Mount Pisgah, and from the top of it, he showed him all the land, but Moses didn't get to enter there. But where's Moses now? Well, he's in paradise. When after the end of this world and after Judgment Day, Moses is going to be with God in heaven for eternity. So as far as not getting to go into Canaan on this earth, I mean, what is that going to mean to Moses' eternity? It's not going to mean anything to his eternity. Now, that generation that when in Numbers 14, when God said, you're not going into the land of Canaan, well, that was a loss for them. But what about when the Holy Spirit swore in his wrath they would not enter into his rest? Which of those two things was significant? I mean, the not going into Canaan compared to not being able to have your soul saved, I mean, there's no comparison there. But that shows the degree of their problem. But anyway, given all that, you would think, in fact, immediately, do you remember how Numbers chapter 14 ends? When God said that and told them, okay, you're not going in because of all this murmuring. And what did they end up doing then? You remember? Their immediate response was to appoint themselves, because Moses wasn't going to go lead them, okay, we're sorry, we're going to go show you, and we're going to go fight the Amalekites, which they did. Moses wasn't going to lead them to do it because they were going to be defeated, so they got their own guy to take them over there to fight the Amalekites, to show, no, we're going to shape up now. And I mean, the Lord knew better. He knew their hearts, but they did that, so they actually disobeyed then to go fight the Amalekites to try to show that they were ready now, and they were defeated. So that's how Numbers chapter 14 ended. They were still rebelling. But if there was ever a time in which they should have sincerely humbled themselves and repented, when the Lord told them that, wouldn't that have been the time for them to humble themselves and rend their hearts and turn back to God and do his will from that point onward? How is it that you get to Numbers chapter 21, seven chapters later, and they're still murmuring? Had they changed their hearts? No. And whatever words they were giving there about, okay, we're ready now to go, and we believe you now, we're going to go, and they didn't. And so they were murmuring some more in Numbers 21. Well, the Lord had already told them, I mean, it was already past the point where he had told them they were not going into the land of Canaan. So that wasn't going to be a punishment. They already had that one. So what did he do then in Numbers 21? He sent some fiery serpents among them that bit them and killed them. And they were dying in droves from that plague that God gave them then. And that's when God told Moses to make that serpent and put it on the pole and to lift that up. And the people that looked at that serpent on the pole then would be healed of their of that plague when they were bitten by those fiery serpents. That's how it ended. Well, we can see from what he says right there, that particular object, And we mentioned at the very close of our time last week that there were certain objects from Israel's history that God had commanded them to preserve, and there were three different objects that were put into the Ark of the Covenant itself. And even though they couldn't go in there and look in the ark as an exhibit, it wasn't like it was an exhibit for them all to see, but God told them to put it. It was there and it was preserved in there in the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant was between the cherubim and the most holy place and the tabernacle and later the temple. But within the Ark of the Covenant were the two tables of stone that had the Ten Commandments written by the finger of God on them. And there was the pot of manna and the rod of Aaron that had budded. Those three objects were in there. But everybody knew it was told by God, and they knew what was in there. They didn't have to actually go see it to know that. I mean, do we have to see the gold in Fort Knox to know it's there? we're not going to get to see that, but it's there. But anyway, Israel knew that was there. And they were told that for a reason. They were supposed to remember the lessons from each of those things. Well, that was the seed of God's authority, and they as a nation were under the covenant with God that they were his people and he was their God. I mean, what was signified by those stone tables and those commandments? And that God preserved them, provided for him. He was there, the one to care for them, and also had borne witness with miracles that the law that he gave them through Moses was his law, and that the authority that he set up over them to govern them from the high priest and Aaron, all that was signified, well, by the pot of manna, that daily miracle they got that sustained them in the wilderness, and then that rod of Aaron that budded. I mean, all of these things had great significance to teach and remind the people, just like the feast days that God had them to observe, like the Passover. So there were certain objects that were preserved, and there were also certain feast days. They had three in the year that each bore their significance so that the people would remember certain things that would direct their minds towards God, remember the things that he had done for them so that they would faithfully serve him. We do not have record that God commanded that brazen serpent be preserved. We do not know whether that was at God's direction or command that was preserved. Obviously, it was not put within the Ark of the Covenant, but it was preserved. Whether it was at the Lord's direction or whether they decided on their own that they were going to keep that as a reminder, they did. But then what did they end up doing with that? So here's an object. In fact, what is the significance of the brazen serpent? Why did God do that? Did God make them, and I don't know if any of you passed an ambulance this morning on your way, but I'm sure you've seen one recently, and if not, it won't be too long before. They're out there, and whenever you see one, what symbol do you see on the side of the ambulance? It's the symbol for medicine. There's a pole with a serpent wrapped around it. Where did that come from? What's the symbol of healing? We probably shouldn't call that to anybody's attention out there because they'll do away with it if they actually became mindful of the biblical origins of the very symbol for medicine. But anyway, why is that the symbol? I mean, that's the symbol of healing. But anyway, this happened. But what was the real reason for it? Did God say, well, since I made fiery serpents to bite them, I'll make a serpent for the pole? And why did God, I mean, he had chosen lots of ways to plague them before. He chose that particular plague, fiery serpents, to make a serpent, put it on a pole for them to look to when it was lifted up. So when they, in faith, looked at what was lifted up, they would be healed of their plague, in that case physical plague. But God did all that intentionally to make a shadow of what he was going to do in sending his son Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus himself said that in John 3 verses 14 and 15, Jesus mentioned that event of Numbers 21 with those fiery serpents and that serpent that was upon the pole there. So the whole reason for it was God's design as a shadow of how he was going to send his son to be the one to ultimately heal mankind of our plague from sin and its eternal consequences if we will believe in him and serve and obey Christ as he would be lifted up on the cross. But that was a shadow of that. Well, to take what was designed by God to be a shadow of his son, that something that was in its origins was God's miraculous work to save them when they didn't deserve it, but he saved them from a plague that he had sent to them. But here was a miracle that God did to save them from that plague. Would that be a good thing for them to remember? As in, let's not do what they did and let's not tempt the Lord, murmur against him and give him cause to send us a plague. But let's remember that lesson that he taught our fathers so that we don't do that. Now, if they had remembered it from that standpoint, would that have been a good thing? Well, that would have been a good thing. But what have they done with this now? They've corrupted it to now where they're actually worshiping the pole and the serpent on the pole. So they've taken what was supposed to be a reminder not to commit the sins of their fathers, and now they've made that itself as a sin that they're engaged in. So what did Hezekiah do about it in 2 Kings 18 and verse 4? I mean, I guess it was back in March, we got to see in the Metropolitan Museum there in New York where they have a huge exhibit of Egypt. And of all these things, I hadn't known this, but the Met back in, going back many, many years, 100 years ago or whatever, they had financed a lot of archaeological work in Egypt. And so they kept many of the artifacts from those excavations. And so there were a lot of these objects from ancient Egypt, I mean, going back thousands of years. And it's remarkable how well they're preserved. That you're looking at something that's 3,000 or 4,000 years old and in very good condition. But just seeing that, I mean, it's astounding. But, I mean, things like that, you know, when you see something really old or historically significant, I mean, those are priceless things. But I mean, this is something that goes back to the time of Moses. And here they are. I mean, so this is going on 900 years after the fact. I mean, centuries later, an object that dates back to Moses himself. And Hezekiah, what does he think of this precious artifact of their history that dates back to the one that God gave their very law to when he delivered them from their bondage in Egypt, and a miracle that he did in the time of their own lawgiver, Moses, that's now centuries old. I mean, this to them, this would be a priceless object that should be teaching them or reminding them of a great lesson. But when it's become something that they're worshiping and committing sin with, what does he do with that? He destroyed it. Was that a mistake that he made? Was this something? What are you doing, Hezekiah? This should be in a museum. I mean, did he make a mistake in doing that? Or when there was something evil and that became a stumbling block for the nation, did he get rid of it? And no matter that it was something that went back to the very time of Moses himself. I mean, that was when this was something that was causing a problem for his people, and he removed the problem. And so this is, this is the only time that this object is mentioned since Numbers 21, other than John 3. And here it is, and it's still around in Hezekiah's time. Also reminds us there's a whole lot of stuff we don't know that God has not told us about. We could ask many questions about a lot of things, we're told what we need to know, there was a lot of history to this object, but we were told nothing about it other than when it was made and then when it was destroyed, and then of course from Jesus what it was actually for in the first place, and what significance that bears to all of us. But anyway, he was getting rid of anything and everything, whatever was a stumbling block to the people of Israel that caused them to commit sin against the Lord. What was Hezekiah's solution to that in chapter 18 and verse 4? What did he do with the high places? What did he do with the images and the groves? And then that brazen serpent that Moses made. He destroyed it all. Everything that was that they were committing sin with, he got rid of it, destroyed it. That was the right thing to do. Now, he's not the first one that has destroyed idols or broken down high places. We've seen that with the few righteous leaders that Judah had as kings before Hezekiah. But when it's his time, and he's the one with the authority to take the action, who's responsible for the spiritual direction of the land now when he's in the position as king? Hezekiah is. And so what does he do with his authority when he knows what all the people are doing? And did somebody have to tell him, you won't believe, Hezekiah, what all kinds of evil your people have been doing for these last several years? Did Hezekiah need a report from somebody else about that? What did he grow up in? That's all he had ever seen in his own house from his father and everybody else. I mean, that's what he was immersed in, that wickedness all around him, and from what his own father Ahaz had done. I mean, it's the corruption went out from there everywhere else. So he was intimately acquainted with the evil that was going on in the land. I mean, he grew up among it. But he made the personal decision that he was not going to follow that himself. He wasn't going to have anything to do with it. And then he was going to make sure that nobody else in Judah, and nobody else that he had anything to do with, was going to have opportunity to continue to do those evil things as far as he could help it. And so he destroyed all that he could that was being used for evil in the land. And so then we get to verse 5 here in 2 Kings 18. And look at this statement. And verses 3 and 5 together, just to read verse 3 again about Hezekiah. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father did. Then we have the statement of verse 5. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. For he clave to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord commanded Moses. I mean, we've got three verses there from 3, 5, and 6 summarizing the life of Hezekiah. And I mean, how many people's lives on this earth are described by God with words like that? Very, very few. But we need to remember this man because he is certainly part of our great cloud of witnesses, those who had faith in God. And now, when we look at the statement there about Hezekiah in verse 5, we do need to look at that very closely so that we don't misunderstand what he is saying or what he is not saying there. When he says about this trust in the Lord God of Israel. That's the same word. We just have come off of a recent study of several lessons about trusting in the Lord. And you might not remember making a big point of this example in that study, which I had that and a lot of other things in the notes. There was a whole lot that was in there that we didn't have time to get to as examples. But anyway, this is that same word for trust that we saw over and over again in those various scriptures that we did look at in that study. That's what it means. And Hezekiah trusted the Lord, it says. Now, later, there is going to be a statement that he's going to make about, God's going to make about Josiah, the last righteous king. This is going to be the great-grandson of Hezekiah. Let's compare a statement that's made about Josiah in 2 Kings chapter 23 and verse 25. About Josiah, the Lord said, "And like unto him was there no king before him that turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, neither after him arose there any like him." Now, many of the words in that verse are similar to, if not identical, to the words that we saw in chapter 18 and verse 5 about Hezekiah. So he's making a statement about each one that there weren't any like him before or after. Well, was Hezekiah before Josiah, and was Josiah after Hezekiah? So at first I'm like, well, how can he say that and say there was none like him before or after him when we just read something about another one before or another one after where he says the same thing? Well, it's not quite the same thing. And that's why we have to be a bit careful there. There's a particular quality in Hezekiah that God hones in on or puts the focus or attention on in chapter 18 and verse 6 that he says about him, there was none like him before or after, and that's also qualified, which you want to get to in a second too. But what did it say about Hezekiah that none before or after him equaled? His trust in the Lord God of Israel. Now, what does it say about Josiah in 2 Kings 23, 25? There was none before like him. Does he use the same word trust there about Josiah? If he used the identical word and then there were two men, one that came before and one that came afterwards, and then God said the identical thing, there was none before or after him that did exactly this, and said it about both individuals, well, we wouldn't be able to reconcile that. Of course, God doesn't do that. There's a difference, which we should be expecting a difference, because if he just said there was none before or after him like that, the same thing, well, you can't have two that are the same in that when he says there aren't anybody else before or after him. So there was none that trusted in the Lord like Hezekiah before or after. What about Josiah? What's the point that he makes about him in 2 Kings 23, 25? There was no king before him that what? Turned to the Lord with all of his heart, with all his soul, with all his might, according to all the law of Moses. Neither after him arose there any like him. So in his turning to the Lord to do all the law of Moses, is that exactly the same as the trust quality that he's mentioning about Hezekiah in chapter 18? There's obviously some shade of difference. Now, they both were righteous. They both, this is Hezekiah and Josiah, they both did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like David, their father. Hezekiah had a trust in the Lord that was unmatched by any before or after him, which would have to include Josiah. But Josiah had a turning to the Lord to do all the law of Moses that was unlike before any before or after him, which would have to include Hezekiah. Now, just as a point of comparison, we read about Hezekiah destroying the high places and things, but Josiah is going to be, Josiah is going to do that too, because there's going to be a lot of rebuilding of these high places and idols. Josiah is going to get rid of that. But he's not only going to repeat what Hezekiah did in that, Josiah went a step further. Josiah was the one in which was prophesied back in 1 Kings 13 by the young prophet that came to Jeroboam that you may remember. God mentioned by name some 200 years before, over 200 years before Josiah did it, that and called him by name, that Josiah was going to be the one that was going to destroy that altar in Bethel that Jeroboam the son of Nebat made. And men's bones were going to be burnt there. Josiah did that. Well, Hezekiah came before Josiah. Hezekiah got rid of what was in Judah. Now, Bethel was actually in the territory of which kingdom? That was of the northern kingdom. Of course, they're gone now under Hezekiah and Josiah. But Hezekiah doesn't go in all the way up into all the land that Israel had ever occupied to get rid of all the high places that still remain from their history. Josiah turned to the Lord to the point that he was going to obey his commandments, that he wasn't going to stop just with the territory of his own kingdom that he ruled over. He was going to go throughout all the land that God had ever given to Israel, that he could do so and destroy all of that and get rid of every vestige from their history of all the wickedness. So he did go a step further than Hezekiah in that. And so when God says about the turning to the Lord to do all the law of Moses like that, I mean, there was a level of zeal in that Josiah had that it was unmatched before by any before after him, including Hezekiah. But this trust aspect, now we're going to read about Hezekiah's situation where he's going to be the king after the Assyrians have taken over and conquered the northern kingdom, removed all the inhabitants, and then they're going to flood through all the land of Judah as the prophet Isaiah foretold, like a flood of waters that would reach up to the neck. And there's Hezekiah, now confined only to Jerusalem, as the Assyrians had taken all the fenced cities of Judah. Everything has fallen in Judah, and he's isolated in the capital and besieged there with his people by this mighty empire. How bleak a situation would that look to be? And then the king of Assyria sends Rabshakeh, his servant, to tell the people and Hezekiah not to trust in the Lord for deliverance, to give up to the Assyrians. Now, looking at that situation militarily, what could they do about it? Not a thing. There was nothing physically Hezekiah could do. Did he try to sneak out an ambassador to go get to Egypt or some other nation to bail him out? Was he turning to men? No, he was in a situation, and Josiah didn't face any kind of a situation that was bleak, where it was, earthly speaking or physically speaking, completely hopeless. The Hezekiah had a choice to make, either to give in to the Assyrians or fully trust the Lord when he had no power at all to do anything, and trust that God was going to somehow deliver him, which the Lord chose to do by sending an angel into the camp of the Assyrians, and he wiped out 185,000 of their soldiers in one night. I mean, did Hezekiah know that's what God was going to do? He didn't know exactly what he was going to do, but he knew God had the power to deliver him, and he trusted him to do that. I mean, how many people have been in a situation that was that strong of a trial on one's faith, like Hezekiah went through, and showed that kind of trust through that? So there's a reason that the Lord singles out that quality that was in Hezekiah that was unmatched by any before or after him. And then that particular quality of turning to the Lord and with that zeal to do all the law of Moses like Josiah. So they each had their very strong point. They were both fully righteous and served the Lord all their days like David. But Hezekiah had a very special quality of trust, and Josiah had one of that zeal in turning to the Lord to obey all the commandments. So we can learn a lot from both of them and need to, but they're not exactly, the statements aren't exactly the same. They are looking at a different quality of heart. Now, can we have all the parts of the love of God and be grown in strength in some particular areas that even more than some others, and still have all of it there, but be particularly stronger in some particular area? I mean, yes, that's an example of that. So having all the, being fully obedient to God and having all the parts of his love doesn't mean that every part is exactly the same in every heart. There can be differences or levels of strength there. We need to grow as much as we can in all of it. But Hezekiah had a very strong area particular to him, as did Josiah. Now, one other thing, because someone said, well, what about David? I mean, they were like David, their father. You mean David didn't trust the Lord like Hezekiah or have a zeal? Now, look at the wording there. Among all the kings of Judah. So he's focusing on this, the kingdom after Solomon, after it split. So is he including David in these descriptions? He's not putting them on a plane above David. He's using David as the measuring stick that they are measuring up to, but he's not putting David behind them. So just note the wording there. There's some shade of difference in the qualities, but he's also confining it to the kings of Judah, the ones that ruled after Solomon. So it would not include David in that. So just mentioning that to pay attention. We always have to pay attention to every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, don't we? And look at it very carefully. But when we do, I mean, there are David is truly unlike any before or after him of any of the kings of Israel. I mean, David is unmatched. He's the one that God measured all the others by. I mean, isn't it true? I mean, they either did like David their father or they didn't. I mean, he was the one that God set up as the measuring stick for all the other kings, because he was the best, the man after God's own heart. But when we look at Hezekiah and Josiah at this point in our study, we're looking at two very excellent examples of faith and righteousness, each in their own way, that we can learn from and be encouraged in the running of our race and following Christ. To seek the Lord like they did. All right, well, we're going to get into more details of the things that Hezekiah did in his reign, Lord willing, next time. We've run out of time this morning, but we'll continue, Lord willing, next Sunday in our study together.